a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us. For those of you on the phone and for everyone in the room, we're happy that you're here. I'm Kelsey Pritchard from the governor's office. And just a reminder, during the question and answer portion of the press conference, for everyone in the room to please use the microphones at the table when you ask a question. And a reminder to everyone on the phone to mute your lines, press star 6. To unmute, press pound 6. Along with the governor, today we also have with us Secretary of Health Kim Malson-Marsden and the Deputy Secretary of that department, Tom Martinek. And with that, I'll turn it over to Governor Dennis Dugard.
Good morning. Thank you for joining for this press conference today. I thought I would talk a little bit about the House Bill 1058 as just some opening conversation. As some of you will know, that's a bill that the Department of Health offers and has taken through the House. Now it's up before the Senate. It's a bill that will update the Department of Health's authority to manage communicable diseases. And currently, you know from the testimony on that bill, if you've been following it, that our statutes have a fair amount of specificity when it comes to managing tuberculosis in South Dakota. If you look at the chapter that this bill seeks to amend, there are quite a few sections in that chapter that are very specifically designed to deal with persons who have tuberculosis, the management of that disease, the prevention of its spread, that sort of thing. And then there's also some, in our code, there's also some general authority to declare an emergency, a public health emergency, to deal with other health threats that are presented to the public in South Dakota. And I became aware with more knowledge of the detail about the ability to declare an emergency and what our authority is outside that declaration when we started dealing with the concern that arose nationwide when we had folks coming down with Ebola in large numbers in Africa and then in a few cases here in America. And there was great concern across the nation. It was certainly a topic on all the news programs and with the president and others. And we had some travelers from those countries where Ebola has been a problem that ended up in South Dakota, and with most of them having low risk, but still having some risk by virtue of having been in those countries. And so we had to look at our protocols that we wanted to follow to be sure that the public was protected in those cases, and we had to look at our statutory and regulatory authority to undertake those protocols. And I want to compliment our former Secretary Deneen Hollingsworth and our current Secretary Kim Malson-Marsden and the Deputy Tom for their efforts to develop good protocols, and I think we have those in place and are utilizing them, and really have had to do very little beyond engage with those travelers, and in every case we've had a very good cooperation from them. The concern that arose as we looked at this situation is, what if we have travelers who are not cooperative and who disregard our requests to isolate themselves or quarantine themselves, would be the better term, quarantine being a healthy person, isolating themselves from someone. What if we have a person who's not cooperative? What do our statutes allow us to do to protect the public health? And so as we looked at the statute, we also looked at, on a broader scale, is it time to update that chapter and try to address more than just tuberculosis, but some other communicable diseases that present serious public health threats to South Dakota, or may in the future present a public health threat. And so House Bill 1058 expands the department's authority to continue to give it some authority over tuberculosis, but also to expand that authority to include now the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, also the Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, SARS, smallpox, and Ebola. So those five diseases. Initially, that bill was broader than that and looked at a larger list, but there was some concern expressed in the legislature that that was too broad, and there was concern that the government might be heavy-handed, and so the department responded with a narrowing of the diseases to those that are passed person-to-person, and those diseases for which no vaccine exists, and where an uncooperative carrier or person at risk may be subject to appropriate isolation or quarantine. So that is where the bill stands as it passed out of the House, and it is before the Senate now. It will eliminate a lot of the very specific tuberculosis statutes and instead have a shorter chapter that gives a little bit more authority to isolate those who are determined to have one of these diseases, and to quarantine those who are at risk of having one of these diseases but don't show symptoms, and then avoid the need to declare an emergency, which might in itself create some public concern that is unwarranted. So I thought I would be useful to discuss that a little bit today, or offer those thoughts and explanations for your interest. And with that, I'll take questions on that topic or any topic that you wish. And I've got, of course, Kim and Tom here to help me respond with more knowledge if that's needed.
Governor, just to follow up on that, in the House, when they amended the bill, they also took off the emergency clause. So now you have a gap of 3 to 4 months, depending when the bill would pass, until July 1, the normal starting date for laws. Are you concerned at all about those 3 to 4 months?
Well, it would be nice to have the emergency clause on there, but of course, it's also a two-thirds vote then. And as it passed out of the House, we wouldn't have had that margin. So now you could have left the two-thirds vote on it, and then if the vote failed, you can strip it off and have it automatically reconsidered. And that could have been an approach that was taken. But I believe at worst, if it passes and something does come up between now and July 1st and we had to declare an emergency, we could still go that route. Although, again, that might create more concern than is warranted by the circumstances. Still, I'm hopeful that in the end the bill will pass with the majority and come into law July 1st.
Changing to another bill, your package of licensing fees for restaurants, hotels, campsites was defeated in a committee, Senate committee. Will you attempt to resurrect that? And I guess secondly, the other part of it would be, what sort of impact does that have on your budget going forward?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. The impact of the failure of the licensing and fees bill is about a $90 million general...
$90,000, excuse me.
Oh, yeah, that is a little bit of money.
But we got a story.
Unfortunately,
there.
I have to deal with millions more often than I like these days. Excuse me, $90,000. And that's something that we can manage. But a $90,000 here and $90,000 there, it adds up to real money. And so that's about a $90,000 amount that the general taxpayers will have to pay for services that are really provided to specific users of those inspections. So if you run a restaurant, You know, it seems to me those inspection fees should be borne by the restaurant and its customers, not all the taxpayers. If you run a campground, those fees should be borne by the campground operator and if necessary, passed through to those campers that use that campground and not all the taxpayers of South Dakota. And that's my philosophy on fees appropriately covering the cost of the running of the program. And in this case, even those fees, if that bill passed, would still not completely extinguish the need to supplement the operations with some general funds. It was an effort to try and get us away from some of the subsidy. In answer to your first question, I haven't talked to the staff about their estimation of what support there may be on the floor. We don't want to smoke out a bill if there's no chance of it passing on the floor, so we'll probably be evaluating that by talking to the legislators and see what they think.
Jackie Severn with Public Radio. I believe your road funding proposal is coming up next week. There's obviously two proposals out there right now, and really only one can be passed in the end, or a compromise. Is there a compromise that you would see as acceptable if yours doesn't get passed?
I'm certainly open to a compromise. I think it's important that we take steps now. I also think it's important for people to realize that if they're shortchanging the need today, then all they're doing is requiring themselves to take hard steps more than once. As we had in the year of the budget cuts, my philosophy is let's do it all at once, take our medicine, and be done with it. So I'm hopeful that whatever compromise, if there is a compromise proposal that finds favor with two-thirds votes in each house, I'd be pleased about that. I hope whatever that compromise may be, that it still is providing adequate funding to make a substantial dent into the need. As I pointed out in my presentation time and again around the state these last few weeks, the amount of money it takes to maintain a good or excellent road is much less than the amount of money it takes to maintain a fair or poor road. And so if we address the need adequately now, it will reduce greatly the amount of money we have to come up with later. And the delay won't save us the dollars that we're going to have to additionally spend.
So right now the other proposal is $100 million, yours is $50 million. So is what you're saying maybe a better proposal for you or a compromise would be somewhere in between that rather than below $50 million.
Yes, I think my proposal is a good one. I like it. I made it. But it's my favorite. But excuse me. But at the same time, one of the charts that I displayed in the state of the state, and you can see online, you'll see the condition of our roads really is very good today. Good and excellent roads are better than 80% in terms of the distribution of road conditions. Better than 80% of our roads are good or excellent at the state system. And that will be true for the next 4 years. So in some quarters, folks might say, well, we don't need to do anything for 4 years. But of course, again, if you wait for roads to deteriorate, then you essentially compound the money that you're going to have to spend. You don't simply wait to spend that same amount of money. But even if you adopt the proposal I'm offering, you'll see that we fall below the 80% mark, and you go out quite a few years, even as far as the chart would show, and we still don't quite achieve a return to that 80% level. It'll take over a decade to get us back to about that 80% mark with my proposal. And some will say, well, let's do a little bit more than that and never fall below 80, or fall below 80 short for a short year or two and get ourselves right back up. And certainly that would be fine with me. All these are projections, of course. They all make assumptions about what road construction costs will be, what the federal tax will be, and all those things are certainly unknown. But I, in answer to your question, yes, I'd certainly be more pleased with a compromise between the two proposals than below mine, because if I thought something below mine was adequate, that's what I would have proposed.
Do we have any questions on the phone line? Any other questions in the room?
I wanted to just address the Medicaid funding a little bit. Democrats have said that's going to be, you know, an issue for them that they're going to bring. Obviously, there was concern about what if the federal government doesn't come through with their portion of the money, state is stuck with that. And they're saying they're willing for compromise to maybe put in a provision to stop SD's Medicaid expansion if funding doesn't come through. Also, they're looking at maybe increasing co-pays for those who pay Medicaid. Is there any compromises you see there that could you could see getting Medicaid pushed through, or is it still just something that you don't think is going to be able to be done for South Dakota?
Well, I've never taken the position that South Dakota should never expand our Medicaid. In each case where I've been unwilling to support expansion, it's been based on factors such as, and largely, our ability to pay. And as you know, the first few years are the consequence to the state budget is a couple million dollars, and then it goes to 10, then 20, then 26, then 36 million. And so that's a pretty quick ramp up. And again, when you look at 20 or 36 million and compare it to the entire revenue growth this year was 49 million. Well, if you're going to carve out 36 of the 49, well, then the 49 is what we used to pay, you know, the increase to the K-12 funding, the increase in the Opportunity Scholarship Fund, the increase to current Medicaid providers for current Medicaid eligibles, and that's, and then a little bit for other things, and it's consuming $49 million. And now we've got to have something like $100 million of revenue growth, or $86 million, $85 million of revenue growth. So to do both. And that assumes that those who are getting the 2% for K-12 improvement in the per pupil allocation, the 2% increase to Medicaid, are satisfied with that. And I'm sure those of you around the table know that there's lots of discussion about how can we get more than that. So the main concern I've always had has been the money. I also think philosophically it's important that we help those who can't help themselves and ask those who can help themselves to do so. And I'll state what I've said many times. Of the 48,000 who would be added to the Medicaid rolls, nearly half of them can get today subsidized coverage or already have private insurance. Something between 11 to 13,000 people already have private insurance in that group. And then we would be putting them on government-paid insurance. I don't know if that's wise, but I'm certainly open to compromise. I'm certainly open to finding a way to meet the needs of people who are vulnerable and who cannot help themselves. I want to help them. I want to do it in a way that's affordable to South Dakota and sustainable. I disagree with the approach that many people take today in many arenas, and that is, well, we can handle it today, and we'll be able to handle it next year and the year after, and we'll worry about those other years when the time comes. Well, that's not my approach to life. And so I want to be sure that when the contribution from the state is going to require our input of $36 million, we somehow know where that's coming from and what sacrifices we have to make, or what those who would otherwise get those dollars would have to make in order to provide them for this group. But in answer to those specific points you made, the trigger, I think that's an illusion. I think politically it is impossible for a legislative body, highly unlikely, I shouldn't say impossible, highly unlikely that the body will allow a group who is seen as vulnerable to be taken off a government program. They won't do it. They won't be able to do it politically. So I think the trigger is illusory. Although many states have pointed to that as something they'll implement and put in their law, it's something that they will change in the year that the federal government fails to keep its contribution level at the promised amount. And the other specific was, I've forgotten.
Copays,
yes. Our experience with copays of any consequence by Medicaid payments is Medicaid eligibles, they don't pay them. They don't pay copays. We've got copays on some of our Medicaid eligibles right now, and they don't pay them. So, thank you for the question. Thanks. Very, very good question.
Any other questions? Thank you all for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.